Welcome to Carnivore Theology, a podcast that answers questions about the Christian faith to help you grow from milk to meat into wise, skilled, world-changing followers of Jesus Christ. With theologian and pastor Chad Graham, author and pastor Al Desjardins, and me, your host, Steve Bastian. Today's question is Harry Potter evil, and should Christians avoid the books and movies, or is that to the contrary? Warning, Harry Potter spoiler alert.
Yes, folks, in our continuing series telling people what's evil and what's not, we've covered, are video games evil? Are tattoos evil? Is alcohol evil? Is anger evil? Is porn evil? Are sports evil? Is season's greetings evil? Are gay people evil? Is 50 Shades of Grey evil? Is Facebook evil? Are psychics evil? Is Wyatt Graham evil? And is Halloween evil? And now we move forward to an even more important issue, Harry Potter. Yes, folks, visit www.carnivoretheology.com for all your is it evil or not needs. We will set you straight.
Woohoo! Okay, I didn't realize we had that many evil wins.
We really, really do. Here we are at Universal Studios Orlando, the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. I am dressed in a black cloak. I got my wand from Ollivander's. I have gone through the sorting ceremony. Chad was sorted into Ravenclaw because of his intelligence and knowledge. Steve was sorted into Hufflepuff because he is a hard-working man who is loyal. And before the hat even touched my head, it's put me into Slytherin. We've been wandering down Diagon Alley.
Makes sense.
And I've taken my seat in the Leaky Cauldron with my good friends. We've ordered three big mugs of butterbeer. I'm having a chocolate frog. Chad's got a plate of chips. And Steve is testing his luck with a box of Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans. So this is fun. I want to live here, Steve. This is where I want to be for the rest of my life.
Have you got one of those vomit-flavored beans yet, Steve?
Oh, I hope not.
No. I'm actually really uncomfortable, guys.
What? This is the best! What is your problem?
Yeah.
Okay.
Chips.
I'm here at the Leaky Cauldron, a pub for wizards, and I'm here with Chad, a pastor of a church, Al, a pastor of a church, both professing theologians, men of the cloth, and they're dressed up as wizards, holding magic wands, and I don't know if this is appropriate, guys. There's things in the Bible that kind of make me think that we gotta be careful around this. I actually think of Acts 19, verses 19 to 20. And a number of those who practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted up the value of them and found it to be 50,000 pieces of silver. So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily.
Huh. Are you advocating a book burning of Harry Potter? Is that what you're trying to say?
I believe I just did, actually. I'm a little cold here, too,
All right, listen, I'm a huge fan of Harry Potter. You got to be careful here. My family has watched the movies multiple times. Even now, we're going through it again. It's kind of a fall Christmas tradition. I love all of it. I can watch these movies over and over and over again, and I get something out of them every single time. You really want to go down the glamorized witchcraft in Harry Potter and my defense of it? Do you really want to go there? Because I'm ready. I could do that right now.
Al's always ready to glamorize anything evil.
I know, he's always ready to find some kind of argument.
No, I don't want to glamorize with... Ironically, I remember I was the bad guy last week, okay?
Right,
when we did the Halloween thing, I was the bad guy, which is really ironic that I'm about to defend Harry Potter because it kind of doesn't seem to line up. How can a guy who is so anti-Halloween be so pro-Harry Potter?
But according to certain fundamentalists I've recently read, that would still make you the bad guy.
That was actually one of my arguments, Al. I had already had lined up. I was going to point out your hypocrisy. So,
Well, no, it's okay. I can do that for you because I live there.
Al actually points out his own hypocrisy.
He calls it life. I like to call it paradox. I prefer paradox. That's what we like to call it.
So I do want to know how you, both Chad and Al, can read Harry Potter, and how would you put that into a Christian walk of life? And
okay, now listen, Chad, do you mind if I go on a bit of a rant right now and a Harry Potter trajectory? Would that be okay if we started with just me doing that? That'd be all right with you?
Let me sit back and enjoy your rant, Al.
You just sit back and relax. Okay, here we go. Ready?
Okay.
Now, I agree. Steve, people like you are not alone. Harry Potter is a tough one for a lot of Christians to deal with. Some believers I know love it. You know, like Chad and me. and other people wouldn't watch it if you paid them to.
He sure puts a lot of words in my mouth, doesn't he?
Christianity Today, Focus on the Family, Plugged In Magazine, they love the movies, they recommend them. However, at the same time, this series is on a list of banned books in a lot of different places, was condemned by the Pope himself, and has been the subject of 6 different book burnings in the U.S. Jack Chick, of the infamous Chick Tracks that we all know and love, he compared Harry Potter to rat poison mixed with orange soda. So,
orange soda's yummy.
Yeah, well, Christians have this knee-jerk reaction, and we rightly do, this knee-jerk reaction to witchcraft and anything that smells of paganism or Wicca.
Just 1 sec, y'all. I guess what we're saying is we need to compare Steve to Jack Chick and the Pope now?
Essentially, what he is Jack Chick and the Pope mixed together.
Yes. I want a pointy hat.
Redneck Southerners burning books they don't understand.
Steve is a chick pope.
Chick right. pope.
Now, we should have that knee-jerk reaction to paganism or Wicca. The Bible clearly condemns the use of magic mediums, necromancers, sorcerers, and the like. The Law of Moses condemns it. The prophets condemn it. The writers in the New Testament condemn it. It even goes so far as to say that anyone who uses sorcery, which is exactly what they're talking about in Harry Potter, they use the word sorcerer or magic, cannot and will not inherit the kingdom of God and are condemned to hell. I mean, it's a really serious thing, so we got to make sure we know. So the question is Harry Potter promoting that kind of anti-biblical sorcery? My answer is, and this is going to shock you, no. The biblical view of witchcraft, magic, and sorcery is one that seeks to influence people by means of supernatural means and occult practices. This, we're talking curses and spells, trying to affect people, compel God or compel a demon or compel a spirit to do things for them, to literally bend people's minds to their will. In fact, anytime any of those things are talked about in Harry Potter, they're called the dark arts or unforgivable curses. The magic in Harry Potter is very different than from what the Bible calls sorcery. In fact, they mostly use it for moving things around and changing one thing into something else, like a bird into a water goblet, or copying something, or making light, or making birds fly out the end of it. If you think of it this way, like any other book, the spells and the potions are used to provide plot devices to make the story interesting. Like Sherlock Holmes' violin, Dr. Jekyll's potion, the One Ring in Lord of the Rings, the portrait in Picture of Dorian Gray, the thread in The Princess and the Goblin. That's what it is. It's a plot device. It's super ironic that the same people who condemn Harry Potter have no problem with Chronicles of Narnia, Lord of the Rings, Macbeth, Cinderella, or 3/4 of the nursery stories that we tell them in the English language, and they all have bad and good wizards in them. At no point ever, and I've seen them a ton of times, do I ever get a sniff of paganism, occultism, or classic witchcraft in any of the books. To my memory, the characters never do things like make occult symbols or chant things or do any of the classic evil pagan stuff. They mostly just follow recipes and point their sticks at things. It's quite innocent.
What with the stick pointing and whatnot? Well, it's all fun and games until someone loses an eye, Al.
That's right. You gotta be careful with the sticks.
Chad, I know you had some information around Harry Potter and an analogy viewpoint of that. Can you elaborate on that a little further?
Well, it's a couple different things. When I hear people say that they are very concerned about Harry Potter and they don't like it, I ask them 2 questions. Have you read the books? And 2, have you understood what you read? The second question is actually extremely important because Harry Potter is actually extremely high-level literature. It's written in some amazing ways, and of course I can talk about some of those if you want me to, but fundamentally, as Al pointed out, the magic in Harry Potter is very different from what is condemned in the Bible, and the reason for that is because what Rowling actually did was go back and draw on the Christian-rooted science of alchemy. Now, some people hear the word alchemy and they freak out and they say, what is that? That's that gibbity gook from the Middle Ages.
I hear a lot of people comparing alchemy to gibbity gook. In fact, that's yes. Generally on the internet, those words almost. Actually, when I type alchemy into my phone, it auto-corrects to gibbity gook.
And actually, that is quite true because the idea of alchemy, right, people think is to change like lead to gold. And it was just some sort of a silly thing. But actually, modern scholars of science are finding that, in fact, most of what we know about alchemy simply is not true. Alchemists were actually proto-scientists that were doing amazing things, which actually led to all the scientific advancements we have today. But one of the interesting things about them is that they were very zealous of their art, and they didn't have copyright laws in their day. So they used complex codes in order to hide the reality of their alchemy, and only those who had gone through their training programs could understand what was being said.
Yeah, their own language.
So basically they cloak their literature in mythic language, but it actually means something relatively mundane. So there are articles that we have translated now, which describe dragons coming out of caves, which really have to do with certain kinds of elements that you find in the earth in natural science. And so we've actually decoded a bunch. We realized that what they really were doing was science, and that science was based within a Christian worldview. And it's interesting that the number one goal of all alchemy was to create something called the Philosopher's Stone. And the title of the first book of the Harry Potter series is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Of course, because the publishers realized that all Americans apparently have less than a grade 4 education, they changed the U.S. version to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, thus confusing fundamentalists everywhere. the real title is quite important because it's pointing to the reality in the framework of Harry Potter. So Harry Potter is written in the framework of alchemy, and as Al pointed out, it's about changing one thing to another, like a frog to a teapot. And these things are part of alchemy. Now, of course, we know that much of it, what alchemy was chasing, never did pan out through experiment. They found it couldn't be done. Some certainly did, but it was about that process. And so the Harry Potter books are not rooted in the kind of magic sorcery that we find in the Bible, but rather in the kind of Christian alchemy magic that we find in the Middle Ages. And what's really cool about that is all the analogies you see in Harry Potter between Muggle science and the world of magic. And all the time you see, for example, Mr. Weasley is really excited about automobiles and trains and all the things and the way that Muggles travel, because it emulates what the magic has been trying to achieve. And what it's really trying to show is that science is magical in the sense in which magic is meant in Harry Potter.
That's amazing. How does one discern the differences between kind of the magical, the sorcery, kind of the negative stuff the Bible is talking about, and then something like this where it's just alchemy, it's looking at a change? That's an important question to me.
Now, I think as Chad said, one of the most important things that we have to do is think through this stuff. Do you understand what you're looking at? I think we have to be careful of listening to our consciences, and we also have to be careful that we know the scriptures and we know what the scriptures are talking about. At the same time, we have to, as we're reading, read with our brains on. Make sure that we read with intelligence, with accuracy, with trying to seek what the subtext is. Make sure we're trying to figure out what is going on with these characters. There's a lot of good things in Harry Potter that I would argue are very positive elements.
Can you give some examples of those?
Okay, J.K. Rowling has stated over and over that Christianity inspired a lot of the things that happened in the Harry Potter books. In fact, she did an interview with MTV where she said that the parallels are incredibly obvious, but she didn't want to talk about it openly until the series was done, because since it was a Christian analogy, it would basically ruin the story. Everyone would know what was going to happen at the end of it. Her own personal faith seems to be something of a secret, though. It's hard to find where she actually says that she's a follower of Jesus, but she does say she goes to church, she's a member of the Church of Scotland, and she believes in God and the permanence of the human soul. Those are all on record from her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to add to that, I watched an interview with her, in which she said, whenever I am asked if I am a Christian, I say, yes, have you not read my books?
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think, I'll admit right now, in agreement with what Chad says, Rowling is a genius in her writing, as smart as anyone. Her work is as good as Narnia and Lord of the Rings. I think that Rowling strikes a balance in between the two. In C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, it's like on the nose, you can't miss it. This is a Christian allegory, boom, 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 in your face. Mm-hmm. Whereas J.R.R. Tolkien, it's in there, but you really have to dig for it in Lord of the Rings. And I think that Rowling goes right down the middle. She quotes scripture, she uses a ton of biblical allusions, but she doesn't beat the reader over the head with it. And when asked, she even said that if she had to summarize the whole series, she would say it's about one thing. It's about resurrection. In the first book, which we just talked about, Philosopher's Stone, that Philosopher's Stone is all about bringing people to life or extending life. And the temptation for Harry is that he would use the Philosopher's Stone to resurrect his parents. Keep in mind, this is Harry Potter is the boy who lived. He was saved by and marked by both love and a curse. He gives his life for his friends. He comes back to life. He conquers evil once and for all. And in the end, he gathers all three Deathly Hallows. He becomes the master of death and then chooses, in his humility, he puts down that power. I think part of the reason, and that's part of the problem, is that the illustration and the allusions and the allegory Rowling painted is incomplete. It doesn't tie up the Christ analogy with a nice little bow. God isn't mentioned at all, although keep in mind he's not mentioned in the Book of Esther either. So Harry Potter is an imperfect allusion. There's lots of room for interpretation. So as Chad said, these, you know, they get confusing. So to me, that's a strength. It is a strength that when we read this, we put our brains on, we try to read it properly. We read it knowing scripture. We read it with a biblical worldview. There's a lot we can gather out of it. But others, they see room for impressionable people to get the wrong message and stumble into bad things.
Yes. Just building off of that, one of the things that makes Harry Potter so compelling and a little bit difficult is the level of literary work. We certainly would compare these books to things like the Chronicles of Narnia and like the Tolkien works. Literarily, they're clearly superior to Lewis. Not saying Lewis wasn't a good storyteller, but literary themes are a different level altogether. They're at least comparable to Tolkien and perhaps even stretch beyond him.
What? So hold on now. Let's slow down.
Wow.
Did you just put Rowling over Tolkien?
Keep in mind, I'm speaking literarily.
We need another episode to cover that one.
Yes. my field of study and my relative expertise has been in what's called biblical theology, which is, in fact, the study of themes as they develop through scripture. And so this is something that I'm somewhat able to speak on. And as you read through the books and you see the development of themes in Rowling, I think they're extremely powerful and actually world-shaping. Mm-hmm. And there are, just to talk about three themes really briefly to share what I mean by that. Okay, Al already said them. You have a serpent who is defeated by a child of promise. Mm-hmm. Through all of the books, right through the whole series, you have Harry going through trials by which he is perfected like gold through the fire. There's some important symbolism that come through the phoenix itself and through some of the other elements in the book. And in the end, of course, Harry gives his life for his friends but is resurrected. But actually, as you're working through, you begin to see these themes developed in nuances that build in very similar ways to the way the Old Testament builds up theology as we come into the fruition of the New Testament. And in the idea of the serpent being defeated, I'll give you one example. And that's it. When you read the books, they all follow a same pattern. They always begin at number 4 Private Drive, and they always end with Harry going back there. In between that, Harry goes to the train station, and he goes off to Hogwarts, and all those different things go on. When they get to Hogwarts, the books always begin with the sorting ceremonies and all that's going on in there. One of the interesting things at the end of just about every book is that the House of Slytherin, the House of the Serpent, is typically defeated over and over and over again. And the way those symbols come out are very fascinating. So in the first volume, Slytherin is in victory. The house has the most points in the internal school championship. Mm-hmm. And so their banners are displayed. And I think you see this in the movie as well, quite clearly, quite dramatically. But what happens is that Harry has lifted Gryffindor over the top, which is a griffin, basically a lion. That's another interesting analogy.
It is, because griffin is actually a Christ allegory and was often known to be a symbol for Christ.
Yeah, exactly. And what you see is the snake banners. I believe in the movie they show the snake banners actually fall. Okay. I can't remember which one's which, the book or the movie on this one now. And then the Griffin banners come into its place, showing the transition. So it's pretty amazing. Just this little thing will be built up all the way to the end with the final victory of the Snake Lord. And so that's one theme that's developed. I give you the most obvious one I can think of. But as you go through them, you'll notice all kinds of little themes like that. They're so compelling, so amazing that you can actually predict by about the fourth book what's going to happen through the rest of the series because the themes begin to develop. But of course, you have to know how to read the themes.
Great.
And that's exactly the point, is that if you're just reading it on surface level and the only two things you're thinking about is, oh my goodness, they use witchcraft, you know, then all you're going to get out of that is going to be negativity, and all you're going to see is that. But if you read it on a deeper level, okay, what is she really trying to say and what's really happening, you're going to get a lot more out of it.
And you know, all the great epics are trying to accomplish something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here, the way I understand it and the way other scholars have understood it, what Rawlings is trying to do is to write a critique of the materialistic worldview that we now live in. And that's the contrast between the Muggles and the people of the magic world. There's an invisible realm the Muggles refuse to see, even though it's right there in front of them. And there's this emphasis, particularly through Harry's uncle and aunt, as foils for that, where they try to suppress the truth of the invisible world, where they try to imagine that it's not real and focus on the very materialistic world. Mm-hmm. And yet the materialistic world itself is under threat from the invisible world. They just refuse to see it no matter what happens in the series. And that's one of the great things, that kids are to read this and start to think, wait a minute, there maybe is something out here bigger than this materialistic world. Maybe this naturalistic evolution I learned in school really isn't the final word. Maybe there is something bigger outside of here that we need to consider.
So you guys are both supporting the book, and I definitely understand where you're coming from. Now, the question I have is regarding to our children. How would we prepare children to read these books? How would we support them in that process if, as a parent, we chose to do that? And how would we defend them with the qualities they need and range of information they need to be able to read these and be able to get those larger themes you're talking about?
The Bible gives us a really good matrix for being able to ask questions about things. You know, it says what...
Wait, is this an Ella matrix?
Well, it's sort of a God matrix.
Can we have the music for Ella matrixes?
No, it's more of a God matrix.
The Ella matrix.
No. I thought about it, and I'm, you know what? I'm not going to do this. God made a better one. You know, so when we think about this, or when God tells us how we should think about these kind of things, we ask the question, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is admirable, whatever is praiseworthy, you know. And so the question is, when we look into this book, what is true? What is good? What is right? Mm. What is noble? What is praiseworthy? Mm-hmm. What are we seeing in here? In what ways do we see Christ? In what ways do we see sacrifice? In what ways do we see friendship, devotion, good conquering evil? This is a strong story with excellent imaginative writing. There's a lot of really good stuff in there. So is it for everyone? And so I would say this. I'm a super fan. I'm going to let Chad answer the other side. But for me, I would say yes, everyone should read this. Maybe there's some people out there who can't handle it. And I would say that for young children, there's some scary elements, but there's nothing there that's going to impact them negatively. And if we as a parent are able to open their minds and say, okay, let's talk about this. What is it? What do you think it's like to have an invisible realm? What do you think it's like to have a friend that is absolutely loyal to you no matter what? What would it be like to have that absolutely loyal friend to you ditch you and get upset with you and then have to come back? You know, what would it be like to have a friend that is knowledgeable of many, many things, but she lacks courage, and therefore you have to have a friend who's courageous. What does that the body of Christ look like when we have many people working together that all have different skills and different abilities and different God-given traits? What's it like when we have Muggles, or we have people that are just dead set against us? They hate us, they don't like us, and they want to make sure that we are we feel horrible about our beliefs of what we think is home. Over and over, Harry Potter says his home is Hogwarts. He loves the magical realm. So what's it like for us as Christians? There's a lot of good questions we can ask from this story. You don't even have to work that hard. They just come bubbling out of it. It might be a little scary for like little kids, but there's so much going on there. There's way too much good stuff for us to pass out.
Yeah.
And of course, that's no different from Tolkien or Narnia. There's scary elements in there as well. One of the things I find interesting is when you're reading Narnia, you have those slap in the face, as you called them, or whatever your phrase was, Christian analogies, but you also have a merger of ancient paganism. I always found that fascinating. Lewis just simply integrated pagan Greco-Roman ideas, the naiads and the dyads and all of that, slapped them right in. He's got pagan gods in there, and he just sort of merged them in. And that's a little bit of Lewis. Lewis has, in I think it's Mere Christianity, where he talks about the universal idea that all the different religions in the world have a core idea that is the same, and we can kind of draw it. I think it's the abolition of man, actually, the Tao. And, you know, Lewis has this idea of merging like that. And in Tolkien, you have world creation. He's created a whole world that's independent of our myths, although it certainly would draw on some of them. In Harry Potter, again, you have world creation, which is amazing. But I think if parents want some really practical help, I can recommend two simple resources. Christianity Today has an excellent article called Harry Potter, Jesus and Me that you can look up on the internet. And that gives you a good sense of what it is. And then I believe that he references the author, but not this particular book in that article. But the book that I would recommend is Unlocking Harry Potter, Five Keys for the Serious Reader by John Granger. And we'll send the links out to those. Mm-hmm. That one is a little bit intense, but it's going to teach you about the history of alchemy and the way it's used in the series. And that part is, I mean, it is fascinating. If you're into that sort of, if you're a nerd and you're into nuanced analysis of your favorite nerdalicious reading, this is the kind of book you will love. If you just like a good story, read the Christianity Today article, tell your kids think about Jesus.
Right.
Practically speaking, that'll help.
I don't know why, Chad, but I really felt judged as you said that. Like, it was like, if you're like Chad and want to do this with intelligence and elocution, then listen to me. If you want to be like Al, you can read this one article, you know, for dummies, and that's about the best you're going to get.
I was actually thinking the opposite. I was trying to impose the idea that I was calling Al a nerd, who happens to know about all these obscure things.
I just felt judged. I don't know why. I just felt judged.
But anyway, as long as you feel judged, my purpose was accomplished.
Now, as a personal question, have you read these books with your kids? And if so, when did you start? At what age? Or what maturity level did you do that?
No, I have not read the books to the kids. We have watched the movies. And I'm not going to recommend this, but my daughter, Eowyn, has been watching them since she was 3. And she's seen the series at least 2 or 3 times.
Nightmare
Patrol.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. You know, like, we're like, okay, we want to watch the series and we want to watch Harry Potter. Uh-oh, there's the baby. What are we going to do? Well, I'll tell you what. I'll just plug her ears during those parts. No big deal. That's how we've been doing it.
I actually have a rule for my kids, and I've used this for all these kinds of things, is for children's movies in particular. If there's a movie based in the book, we have to read the book first. Mm-hmm. I have two reasons for that. One is because I'm trying to inculcate a love of reading. And secondly, because it allows us to control the pace, to discuss all the issues. So if there's a scary scene or a scary character, it's within the safe confines of a conversation with your parent and an understanding of it. And they get to see in the end the conclusion of the story. And then we go and we enjoy the movie. And they're not scared at that scary scene because they know that, in this case, Harry lives at the end of this particular movie, or they understand what this negative character is like, and we've had quite a discussion of it. And I found that very helpful. And we talk about the kind of themes and the way these relate to our Christian walk as we go through the book, and we do it slow. So with my 8-year-old, we're on the fifth book, I believe, and my younger son, he doesn't follow along quite as well, so he reads, you know, bits and bits of the book as we go through it and talk about it. He's 4 years old. And of course, my 18-month doesn't get to read.
I could talk about this all day long. And yeah, the problem is that they're starting to shut down our Leaky Cauldron here. And they're asking us to leave. They've asked us to pay the bill 25 times. So I say what we do. Steve, yeah, I want you to give each one of us a Birdie Bot flavor bean. We're going to try it and we're going to see how it goes. I've found a pink one. I'm hoping it's cotton candy. Okay. Chad?
Mine's green.
Chad,
I a green one.
I'm
be.
Hoping that's lime or something like that. And
yeah,
Steve,
yeah, probably.
You should have a really nice toffee flavored one. Okay, toffee. So everybody.
Oh, that'll be good for Steve.
1, 2, 3.
Go. Oh, that tastes like boogers.
I don't know. I don't think I've tasted this before, but if I have to guess, I'm going to say earwax. Whoa.
Why is Al throwing up? Did he get a vomit?
Oh, that's awful. Give me more
I
butter beer.
I put something in my mouth.
More butter beer
more butter
over
beer.
Here right now. I don't care if you're closed.
I've never had this much sugar in my life as there is in this butter beer business.
Wow.
This has been Carnivore Theology with Chad, Al, and Steve. Thank you for listening today as we discuss the Harry Potter series. To find out more about Carnivore Theology, or if you have any questions or topics you would like us to cover in upcoming episodes, let us know by visiting us on our website, www.carnivoretheology.com, or leaving a message on our SpeakPipe page, speakpipe.com/carnivoretheology. If you like what we're doing, please share with your church and friends, like us on Facebook, rate and subscribe to us on iTunes, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. We encourage you to connect with your local biblical church and keep your eyes on the cross.
This time for sure, presto.
Hello again!
Hey, Internet!
We solved Chaz's computer issues.
Wait, my computer issues?
Yes. It was you.
Oh. It was me?
Welcome.
Why is it always me?
Because you're a Luddite, Chad. Just deal with it.
We really, really do. So, but here we are at Universal Studios. Here we are at Universal Studios Orlando.
That was worse than Steve.
At Universal Studios Orlando, the world of... One more try. Here we are at Universal Studios Orlando, the wizarding world of Harry Potter. I like to call it Paradox. I prefer Paradox. That's what we like to call it.
I have a pair of ducks. They are right there.
We had some ducks. They've actually flown south for the winter. It's kind of turning cold here now.
Okay.
Okay, so listen here.
So Al actually has a wand.
I've got my wand. Here it is, right here. I want to show you my wand, okay? This is it. I went and bought this. It's actually what's called a spirinella. It's used for making oatmeal in Scotland. But to me, that's a Harry Potter wand.
Making oatmeal the Scottish way pretty much is witchcraft.
It's magic. It's just magic. Okay, listen.
You know it's thick enough when it stops a bullet.
Yeah, you guys know St. Clair Ferguson?
Yeah.
He's a great Scottish theologian and pastor, and he has a story about growing up, and his mother would always make him oatmeal. And she would always make oatmeal with salt in it, and it wasn't very good, and he kind of didn't like it. And he found out that the English put all kinds of sugar and cinnamon and other things in their oatmeal. So he asked his mother one day, "Mummy, why can't we have sugar in our oatmeal?" And his mother said to him, "Because that's the way the English eat it."
The English put sugar in everything, including toothpaste.
My sister-in-law covers her eyes at all the scary parts in any show. I think even, you know, that's funny to see a mature adult cover their eyes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Al does that too. Yeah. But he doesn't want to admit it publicly. By the way, if you need to try some butterbeer, head over to Starbucks, and I believe they're offering it. Starbucks, if you're hearing this, please send your donations in to Carnivore Theology for the reference.
We will push any of your product any day, all day long. Chad?
Yeah?
That was for you.
Okay.
Because you did that all episode. Honestly. I have to get rid of all of them.
Absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
Jeez.
Chad is just, he is Batman.
Honestly.